I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of November, the week of Thanksgiving. All things political this hour with Professor Lily Gorin, Professor of Political Science and Global Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, editor of the book Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics, author of Not in My District, The Politics of Military-Based Closures, and You've Come a Long Way, Baby, Women, Politics, and Popular Culture. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We, of course, will start with how the presidential candidates are addressing ISIS. We'll look at this interesting developing story, expanding internal Pentagon investigation of CENTCOM, showing that supervisors revised their conclusions to mask some of the American military's failures in training Iraqi troops and really taking on the Islamic State. So how do we know what kind of information we're getting and whether or not it is the truth? Hillary Clinton gives a major address on foreign policy, and this will probably be an area in which she will shine during the remaining months. Polls show that more than 50% of Democratic primary voters are very confident in her ability to handle an international crisis. And yet, Bernie Sanders has zeroed in on Wall Street donations to Hillary Clinton. He has new TV commercials that started in Iowa and in New Hampshire on Saturday. The truth is, you can't change a corrupt system by taking its money, is what Bernie Sanders says. Donald Trump has been saying a great deal about Syrian refugees. He also, and I'm not sure where he's getting this because it certainly has been discounted, has said that he watched in New Jersey when the World Trade Center came down and thousands of people were cheering. And so we ask, what was he talking about and how disconnected voters may be from basic facts and the truth and why that is the case. He also said that a black protester who was roughed up by people at one of his rallies over the weekend, maybe he deserved to get roughed up, and we'll talk about that. He still retains commanding leads in Iowa and New Hampshire, and so we will be talking about Donald Trump. All of that and more this hour, and we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at KDunn. Show. Professor Lily Gorin, thank you for joining us again. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, my pleasure. We have so much to talk about. Let's start with Syrian refugees. Most Republicans, many Democrats are now saying we're a little concerned about admitting Syrian refugees. And also we have a Bloomberg, I think, poll showing that a majority of Americans oppose the idea. Should the process be paused? What do you think?
I don't know if the process should be paused. It's been an incredibly slow process of integration of refugees into the United States to start with. And I think the suggested average amount of time that it takes a refugee from Syria or elsewhere to sort of move through the process is about 2.5 to 3 years. And so we haven't taken all that many, and from what I understand of the process itself, it is quite extensive. I'm not necessarily sure that pausing it now would have a direct impact per se on, you know, some of the folks that were involved in the things that happened in Paris 2 weeks ago. Those were, from what I understand, all either Belgian or French national.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that any of the candidates, Hillary Clinton gave a major speech before the Foreign Relations Council in New York on how she would handle this threat. Does it behoove her candidacy well because she knows about the intricacies of foreign affairs? Are there other candidates? Well, that's one question. And are there candidates who really are rising to the occasion, giving us complete and important answers to how we take on ISIS, Lily?
Well, I don't know that anybody has a complete and clear ideas of how to take on ISIS. So I think that, you know, certainly somebody who has potentially more experience with regard to foreign policy may have at least some more information at their hands, or they've been briefed on more of the sort of situation. But ISIS is also, you know, sort of it operates, from what I understand, and this is a, you know, sort of not exactly my bailiwick of expertise, but from what I've been reading and sort of hearing commentators who are much more expert than I talk about, is that, you know, there's ISIS in Syria, ISIS in Iraq, where they, you know, they have some hold on various parts of those countries. And then there's, you know, then there are these sort of terrorist cells that are in lots and lots of different places, that have some connection maybe to some of the folks in, say, Syria or Iraq, but may also be operating fairly independently once they are no longer connected to those folks in, you know, in Syria or Iraq. So, you know, we've been bombing Syrian ISIS strongholds for over 15 months, I believe. And so it's a question of, you know, folks who are, as I said, like French nationals, getting training in Syria or other places and then coming back to their home country and plotting these kinds of attacks.
Mm-hmm. I found this CENTCOM investigation, and it's only really just beginning. It would appear to me, from what we're learning so far, that the administration is getting really bad intelligence from CENTCOM. They're doctoring reports saying that we're doing much better than we are. Maybe that's where the president got this. We have contained ISIS, when indeed we have not contained ISIS. Is this a troubling thing that's happening, that the information that's coming is not reliable?
And, you know, this is sort of a perpetual, it's a perpetual issue with regard to intelligence information. And, you know, I work with my students in a public policy class where we look at, like, the intelligence information that was provided, that was known and provided before 9/11. And some of it is that, you know, the intelligence information is there and provided, but, you know, what the impact of particular things would be is not as clearly known, and this issue with regard to the recent sort of Pentagon inquiry into the intelligence is also about, like, who has what information. We have 17 different intelligence agencies in the United States, and they don't always talk to one another.
Mm-hmm. Frank Bruni had an interesting piece in yesterday's New York Times. I want to quote part of it to you now. He was critical of President Obama, and here's part of what he said. He, President Obama, was at his worst just after the Paris attacks, when he communicated as much irritation with the second guessing of his stewardship as he did outrage over Paris and determination to destroy the Islamic State. There was an onus on him to make abundantly clear that he grasped the magnitude of the threat and was intensely focused on it. From Obama, we needed fire. Instead, we got embers.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty critical of the president's response to Paris. He was also fairly critical of many other candidates' response to Paris. And I think, I mean, I guess part of what he's getting at is also that the pendulum on either side is swinging with regard to, you know, what should we be doing with regard to ISIS? How should we be responding to this kind of, you know, sort of existential terrorism as a country? As I said, you know, we've had, what, 8,000 bombing raids with regard to ISIS strongholds in the Middle East for 15 months, but that doesn't necessarily stop a terror cell in Beirut or in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, it goes back to the immediate discussion also following 9/11 is, how do you change people's hearts and minds, which you usually can't do effectively necessarily with bombing raids.
Let's talk about Donald Trump, because I guess we need to. He still has a solid lead in Iowa and also in New Hampshire. A couple things over the weekend. He dismissed accounts of his apparent support for creating a registry of Muslims in the United States. He did say that he wanted a database of refugees entering the country from Syria, and he wants a surveillance of certain mosques. Then he gets into this, hey, I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down, and I watched in New Jersey, Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. What is he talking about?
I don't know, because apparently the police at the time in New Jersey investigated that and found no evidence of it, from what I understand.
So why is it that people support him in the numbers that they appear to, Lily, that he's at the top of the polls? He doesn't seem to be dwindling very much at all when he comes out with these kinds of statements, in addition to the president wasn't born in Kenya. What does that say about people?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of things sort of in what and who Donald Trump is appealing to in his presidential candidacy. And I think that a variety of the things or the people that he's appealing to have to do with his role as a sort of political outsider. And so one of the sort of striking qualities of his entire campaign has been, you know, he basically sort of says lots of things. He's been doing this since the beginning, when he announced his candidacy and was talking about how Mexico sends us rapists and murderers and so forth. And then he sort of moderates it a little bit, or sometimes occasionally walks it back, or, you know, sort of massages what he said. With regard to the commentary about the cheering when the Twin Towers fell, I don't believe he's walked it back at all, but I don't know.
Yeah, he hasn't. He probably will at some point, and then it's just sort of forgotten. But you don't forget these things if you're looking at a presidential race where you simply have to be serious about who you elect when the world is in the state that it's in right now. Not that it's always been in a good state, but there are pressing issues that it would appear to me need to be talked about quite seriously.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the critique of Donald Trump as a presidential candidate, is that, you know, that was one of the people at one of the more recent debates started out by asking him and said, you know, you sort of are a cartoon character of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, part of what the, you know, sort of what the peculiarity of the Trump campaign is. And it's not that it's not appealing, but that he, you know, he does say things that most, quote, establishment politicians, people who have been elected to office before, generally don't say, or if they say them, they are not successful in, quote, getting away with saying those kinds of things.
One more thing on Trump, and then we'll go to phone calls. We have many coming in. There was also a black protester at one of the events over the weekend from Black Lives Matter. He was saying, dump the Trump and Black Lives Matter. Get him the hell out of here, was Trump's response. And then this person was beat up by people who were in the crowd. And Trump's answer is maybe he deserved to get roughed up.
Yeah, and that happened. Something similar to that happened a couple months ago, also at a Trump rally. And Trump's response was fairly similar. And then afterwards, he kind of did walk it back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, Mr. Trump started out his candidacy with regard to, you know, sort of being able to draw media attention to himself a lot without having to go through the usual sort of mechanisms, not running ads, not necessarily having a lot of retail politics, not going to, you know, barbecues all the time in Iowa and New Hampshire, but spending a lot of the time either saying things that brought him attention or, you know, making himself very available to the media so that there was constant attention focused on him. And for a long stretch of time, it was a pretty inexpensive campaign that amassed him more media than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders started TV commercials, lots of them in Iowa and New Hampshire on Saturday, getting at Hillary Clinton. on Wall Street. New York Times front page story yesterday, Wall Street ties linger as an image issue for Clinton. They mention $3 million in campaign contributions for speeches, $17 million in campaign contributions over the years, a vulnerability in states with early nomination contests. Would you agree she is vulnerable on this, that it is a good direction for Bernie Sanders to go, or does he need to brush up more on foreign policy, and does this become a non-issue as this terror threat stays with us?
Well, I think that, you know, I think the terror threat will also continue to be an issue in the campaign for both the Democrats and the Republicans, as well as, you know, for President Obama, and to some degree, you know, any Democrat who's running, be it Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, or Hillary Clinton, are running in some manner connected to the president because they're from the same party. But the issue then becomes not necessarily one with, you know, is it the terror threat or is it the economy, but for Sanders, his focus has been fairly consistently and substantially on the economy. And so he's trying to capitalize on his strength with regard to that, while trying to potentially shore up some of his weaknesses on foreign policy. With regard to Clinton, I think, you know, in a certain sense, the situation that she's coming out of is one where she is somewhat vulnerable with regard to the issues around income inequality and her connections to Wall Street in that regard. So Sanders does have something to work with there. But, you know, the same thing is going on the Republican side as well with regard to some of the critiques of, say, Ben Carson,
yes,
who's mostly second in the polls behind Trump, and his, you know, to some degree, his lack of information or lack of study on foreign policy, not dissimilar necessarily from some of the critiques of Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Although Sanders seems to have a much better grasp of foreign policy than Ben Carson, if we're going to be honest about it. Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number, if anything has struck your fancy that you'd like to comment on, feel free to move us into other directions as well. It's All Things Political this hour. Professor Lily Gorin, Professor of Political Science and Global Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, is our guest. Our lines are filled, but just keep the number in your head, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political, Professor Lily Gorin is our guest, and we start our calls with Joe in Nina. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. WPR is a great, the best stations in Wisconsin. My question is about the primaries and the caucuses. If you could walk us through the calendar leading up from the first primary up through Wisconsin, which I believe is in April, what other states are in between, and in particular the Iowa caucus. I have friends who live in Iowa City. They always go to their caucus, and they said it's a great time. And would I be able to attend as a non-resident, non-voter, to an Iowa caucus? I'm particularly interested in attending the Republican caucuses because I think it would be a hoot just to observe. Do I need press pass, or can I just walk in as an observer, non-resident of the state of Iowa in particular? Finally, let me just say that I'm a graduate of Carroll College, last century. It remains a good institution, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Joe. Lily.
Thanks, Joe. It's always good to hear from a Carroll University graduate, but when he graduated, it was Carroll College.
Yes.
The primary calendar, from what I understand, of course, the first one, the caucuses in Iowa are first, and they are February 1st, I believe. And I believe that anybody can go to them, but you can only vote if you are, if you live in Iowa. And I know students of mine have gone to the caucuses from out of state to observe them and see what's going on. And so you're certainly welcome to go. I don't believe you need press credentials. And the caucus experience, when I lived in Minnesota, I went to the Minnesota caucuses, and the caucus experience is an engagement, mm-hmm, with your community. It's, I mean, we go into a voting booth and we vote privately and we vote by ourselves, and you know, you see people you know in line. But the caucus is one where you actually go and you have conversations with people and you try to persuade them to support a candidate that you want to support. And so you really have to, you know, sit down with your neighbors and talk to them about what matters to them and why you think one candidate is going to do a better job than another one in terms of representing those issues. So they're sort of democracy in action in that regard. They're conversations and deliberations, and they go long into the night a lot of the time too.
Mm-hmm.
I'd encourage anybody, if they're interested, to sort of, you know, we can go up to our pals to the north in Minnesota. They have caucuses, and of course Iowa is the first one. The next one is the New Hampshire primary, and again, this is always interesting with regard for political scientists to look at. The differences between the way caucuses, the outcomes in a caucus, and the outcomes in the primaries, because the primaries, again, are, you know, that's your sort of secret ballot, and you go in New Hampshire and you get your ballot and you vote. And the outcome in that has been in the past distinct from whoever wins the Iowa caucuses. And so then the next one after that is South Carolina has a Republican primary, and then Nevada. This has been sort of the four states that in the last number of presidential election cycles have been the important ones: Iowa, New Hampshire, then South Carolina, and Nevada. And then you start getting into the sort of the so-called Super Tuesdays, because March 1st you have a whole bunch of different states that are going to vote. Across the board, from Georgia to Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, and then March 5th, you have a bunch more, not quite as many. And so you do, you know, you sort of have the individual states, the front end of the primary and caucus sort of calendar, and then you have a couple of these breakout opportunities with regard to more states. But that means, as a candidate, you've got to have the money to run your campaign in more places than one at a time, or two at a time with Iowa, New Hampshire.
And thank you very much for your call. Our phone number for all things political is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Of all the presidential candidates, who do you think is handling the ISIS threat and the plan to eliminate ISIS the best? What do you make of some of what Donald Trump had to say over the weekend, and how disconnected he may be from what the truth is, and why so many people embrace a candidate who said some things that are not truthful? What does that say about us? We're looking at the primaries. We're looking at Hillary Clinton and how she gave a forceful speech on foreign policy. Will that issue dominate, do you think, the campaign? And will it weed out certain people like Ben Carson, who doesn't seem to have a very good handle on foreign policy? Or will Wall Street, being too cozy with Wall Street, charges that Bernie Sanders has leveled against Hillary Clinton in recent TV ads, will those be as important as foreign policy issues? We welcome your thoughts on all of that, because this is All Things Political. Dave in Menominee, Michigan is next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I wanted to bounce back a little bit to Donald Trump and a lot of the things that he says. Even he wants to bring back waterboarding. And he just doesn't drop. He still maintains his lead.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to... I think fear has a lot to do with what's going on. I think people are just, there's almost a hysteria that's been peddled for, you know, almost 8 years now. I mean, remember how Ebola was being used for fear, and ISIS was coming across the border with Ebola, and they just use fear and peddle it, and daily outrage every single day, and how it affects the human brain, and how we change our minds because of fear. And I just wanted to get the guest's thoughts on it.
Yeah, but Dave, before we do that too, there are reasons to be fearful, right? I mean, what's going on can lead people to be fearful.
Attacks in Paris, I don't know. You know, they were right off the bat, they blamed Obama. It's just total fear I think it makes us accept things and be complacent, when we really shouldn't be that afraid. I don't think that we should be that afraid. You know, we should have more of an attitude like, you know, let's see you try it. And knowing that we're going to be able to defend ourselves, knowing that we'll be able to recover from it.
Hmm. Professor Gorin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think Dave raises a good point, and part of it is in the, you know, post 9/11 period, that there has been an increase in the level of fear that Americans feel with regard to these kind of external, to some degree, existential threats from places that and people who we are less familiar with. I mean, for 50 or 60 years, we had fear with regard to the Soviet Union and you know, sort of the nuclear threat from the Soviet Union, at the same time that we also had, you know, there were smaller kinds of terrorism going on both here and elsewhere. But in the post 9/11 period, there has been the sort of this base level engagement with concern that we have these kind of this threat of terrorism from places that we don't know or understand, and ISIS is to some degree fitting into that kind of an equation, because it's not, you know, it's not a state-based organization that we have long structured our defense around, and so we have reconfigured a lot of our defense with regard to fighting more elusive threats. But at the same time, I think that the caller points to some of the concern with regard to, you know, we have the largest, most substantial, most advanced military in the history of the world. Does that make us impenetrable? No. Does that make us, you know, are we able to respond to a variety of different kinds of threats? Absolutely. But we also have, you know, we have homegrown terrorists. I was talking last week with my students about Timothy McVeigh, who is a homegrown terrorist.
Mm-hmm. I kind of missed this story. Maybe, I don't know where I was. I follow the news pretty closely. But the other thing, we've done shows on refugees, and it is true that the process to become, to get into the country is incredibly elaborate and takes a couple years. Somebody wrote yesterday, and I just wrote this down, there is no common sense reason to believe that a terrorist is as likely to enter the U.S. amid those screened refugees as by crossing the Mexican border, which was apparently the intent of five Syrians with stolen doctored Greek passports who were stopped in Honduras last week. I don't know how I missed that story, but was that a big story?
I don't think it was a big story. I mean, I saw it, but I didn't see a lot of information on it.
Yeah. So people can get in here. I mean, it's...
The 9/11 bombers
absolutely
came in through
absolutely
Canada, you know?
Right. Right, from Saudi Arabia, we might add.
Right.
Which is another element to the whole story.
Right.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. Dimitri in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, yeah. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, your phone's a little shaky here. Can you get closer?
Absolutely. Sorry
okay.
about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I had to unmute myself. Anywho, I had a kind of a twofold comment, so you can go with it whichever way you want.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dimitri. You'll have to call back. We just can't struggle through it. We can't hear you very well. 800-486-8655 is the number. Mike in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I want to ask your guest, looking back in history with the Emperor of Japan and the United States defeating them, how did we convert all of those people away from believing in the Emperor and that he was God? How do we convert the radicalized Islam people away from that? Is there any parallels, or is there any tools or you know, methodology that was used? I see this, you know, tens of thousands of these people being radicalized. How do we convert them into being normal members of society without the military having to annihilate every one of them?
That's a really good question. Lily?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not an expert on the psychology, and so you may need to get somebody who's more of a psychology professor. But part of it is, you know, what the United States did following World War II, both in Japan and in Europe, was to come in there and basically help the societies that had been decimated by the war economically. And that's a lot of American imperialism for the last 200 years has been a form of economic imperialism, whether you want to call it imperialism or not. But, you know, it's to sort of come in and sort of say, well, you know, we were just involved in this, and we were enemies, and now we're not enemies anymore, and actually we'd like to help you so that you don't become our enemy again. The difficulty is, of course, that we've been engaged in the Middle East in a variety of ways for, you know, over 100 years as a country, as well as most of the European countries have been there for a lot longer than that. And there are, you know, there are engaged sort of conflicts that we have to some degree neither side on, and part of that is more complicated than, you know, sort of defeating a country as we did with regard to Japan or Germany or Italy, and then coming in and sort of saying, well, you know, let's help you get back on your feet, because that was, of course, one of the lessons we learned from World War I, was that we didn't do that. So it is a complicated sort of situation, and that's been also part of what the sort of emphasis has been often with regard to our role in places like the Middle East or in developing countries, has also been to, you know, try to economically advance some of these countries so that individuals aren't feeling just desperate and disconnected, and thus perhaps more willing to take up arms against the United States or other folks who they see as the enemy.
Yeah. There's also this element of, you know, they found some part of the Quran and these people are disaffected. That woman who blew herself up in Paris and earlier, not that much earlier, tried to go to date sites. I saw her in a bubble bath somewhere in a Paris hotel, and then all of a sudden she's blowing herself up. And you've got that Time story yesterday on the women of ISIS was incredible. These women who had fairly, you know, kind of modern lives in Syria and married ISIS fighters, and they escaped, but their stories could be told. But there's something about people latching on to this jihad against non-believers that they believe in, and they're just violence, and they're killing for the sake of killing as many people as they can and taking over the world. I mean, it's sort of hard to take that on with
McDonald's.
You know, yeah, isn't it?
It is. I'm not disagreeing with that, but I do think that gets at some of it, though. And at the same time, it is a question of, you know, what is the situation in which you find individuals that they are so disaffected? What is surrounding them that is making them disaffected or unhappy or generally discontent with their situation?
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Lily Gorin is our guest this hour for All Things Political. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, editor of the book Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics, and author of other books as well. And we're talking about ISIS. We're talking about the political response to ISIS. We're talking about the presidential campaigns and the issues that are likely to stay with us as we get closer and closer to the 2016 presidential vote. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our lines are ringing right now, but keep this number in your head and call us when you'd like, 800-486-8655. We always welcome emails at talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, where we love to read your comments always, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lily Gorin now for All Things Political. 800-486-8655 is our number. Saeed in Green Bay is next. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, you guys have been speculating about why Donald Trump leads in the Republican side by about 10 points over his opposition, despite some of the very stupid things that he says. And I'm not a Donald Trump supporter. But I would also say, isn't it a bigger anomaly that on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton leads by more than 40 points, when she has lied about matters of national security as important as the cause of the attack on Benghazi and the murder of our diplomats there. Why is that not an anomaly? And why don't we speculate about that?
Professor Gorin.
Well, I mean, I think that Hillary Clinton has also spoken in front of a variety of different committees in Congress discussing Benghazi. I think she's spoken 3 or 4 times, I believe. And I think there has been a lot of discussion of what she said at the time of the attacks and what, you know, what has been the reports, various reports with regard to what happened at that point. I don't think there hasn't been discussion. I think, in fact, there's been quite a lot of discussion of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. I just had a very different take on that same article, the women in Syria who are joined the Al-Qansa Brigade. Mm-hmm. You mentioned their radicalization. I took from the article that they really felt forced to join, which makes me wonder, is a lot of the support there, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, and somehow getting to the into the mindsets of those many who have joined out of just fear of not joining, maybe those are far greater than the numbers who actually believe this stuff, and somehow our response, you know, whether it's bombing them with leaflets in Arabic, I don't know, but some other very psychological support rather than seeing them as the actual perpetrators. Anyway, mm-hmm. It's just a thought I had.
We're trying to get the author of the piece on a show too, Jeff, just for
great. I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, Jeff. So would I. Lily.
Well, I mean, I think this is often the case in some of these conflict-rich environments is, you know, what are people doing just to sort of keep themselves and their family from being killed? And how much do people have to comply with mm-hmm. some of the demands made in some of these more fanatical environments in order to sort of keep themselves alive? I mean, I think we saw a lot of this during the reign of the Taliban as well, that you had people, individuals, women in particular, who had to comply with not leaving the house and not going to school and stuff just to make sure that they and their family were not punished in some capacity. And so I think that it is a question of how deep the affinity for some of these organizations runs when so many of the individuals living under these regimes feel so completely threatened by them.
Mm-hmm. And according to this article, what was eye-opening to me is that we don't get many reports like that. We don't know very much about what's going on inside, but the evident hypocrisy of some of these fighters who are... there was a picture of a huge cigarette burning. They were burning cigarettes, and nobody can smoke in the areas that are under their control, but they all smoke.
Right.
And which is a small thing, but I'm sure there are other indications that it's not entirely following the line. So thank you very much, Jeff, for your call. What I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to move off of this for a moment into other areas. Do you have any, you reeled off when all the caucuses and primaries are taking place. What about debates, Lily? Are we gonna hold for a little while with debates?
I think we're like on the Thanksgiving hold.
Okay.
But I don't have them at my fingertips. But I know that I thought there were like 16 debates or maybe 12 debates that the Republicans had scheduled, and I thought the Democrats had scheduled something like 8 or 9. And as the voting starts, then we'll also have debates at that point. You may have fewer people on the stage, possibly, mm-hmm. On the Republican side in particular, as people, you know, can't sort of get the money together to campaign in certain states, and others may pull out, or they may not. But there, you know, there will be debates, I would assume, that continue through the winter.
And do you have any idea why in the world the Democrats have scheduled their not nearly as many debates as Republicans at these weird times, Saturday night, Friday night?
I mean, there's a lot of speculation about that, in part because there's, I think, a lot of presumption with regard to Hillary Clinton being the sort of the designated nominee, even though she hasn't won a primary or a caucus yet. And at the same time, it is free publicity.
Right.
And so one would think that, you know, the Democrats would want some of the same free publicity that their friends on the other side of the aisle are getting through all of their debates. But they're also probably not going to attract as many viewers, in part because there aren't as many people running.
Mm-hmm.
Although they did, you know, the first Democratic debate that was on the Friday night did, in fact, attract a sizable audience for something that was on a Friday night on television.
Right.
A very low ratings night.
Scott in New Glarus, our next caller for you.
Good
Hi,
afternoon.
Scott. Hi.
As far as post-World War II, when we, I guess you would say, rehabilitated Germany and Japan, they were forward-looking countries before and after. They wanted to advance into the future. The ISIS and the jihadists want to go back to the 12th century, and I think that makes it very difficult to try to fix this. Granted, Republicans would like to take us back to the 1950s, the Leave It to Beaver era. That's easier to deal with. But when you're working with a bunch of people that want to go back to the 12th century, that seems to me to make it. That's what makes it so difficult to try to get in their minds and say, look, there's a better future, as opposed to going back to the 12th century.
Professor Gorin.
Well, I mean, I think that Scott's correct in that regard, that any number of the countries in the Middle East are sort of toggling between this issue of, you know, sort of older, more traditional, and generally speaking, more ancient traditions, and modernization, and what modernization and advancement means, progress means. And I mean, it's not only ISIS that sort of is operating in this regard, but a lot of the Gulf states. You know, if we start to look at places like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and so forth, which have amazing technology and, an amazing modernization, and yet culturally we look at them and say, you guys have a long way to go. And so that there are some cultural dynamics at work that are also to some degree working against what was going on in Europe or in Japan following World War II, which was to, you know, try to be forward-looking, industrialized, progressive, etc. But, you know, we've also seen sort of the back and forth that advanced countries go through, that, you know, with progress also comes often a backlash or a return or an interest in returning to, quote, simpler times.
Thank you, Scott, for your call. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Quite a few years, well, I don't know how long ago it was, but it seemed like 5 to 10 years ago they were talking about the where a lot of the Pakistani Indians, Middle Eastern people are living in places like Paris and London and metropolitan areas in Europe. And I see in current news that they're referred to as suburbs, when in fact, in the past I've been reading how much they're like slums and how segregated they are from not just geographically, but they're segregated from opportunities for work and, help through governmental agencies and so on and so forth. I'm wondering if that's current today, and this is why it's such a breeding ground for people who may turn out, who may be looking toward joining ISIS or whatever, and what a breeding ground, trading ground it might be, present itself as today.
Professor Gorin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Mike is hitting on one of the issues that has been difficult for a number of the advanced European countries that had, you know, that have these colonial legacies. And we should also all remember a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that there were any number of riots throughout the suburbs, the outer suburbs of Paris, as well as a number of the other French cities, that was a sort of energizing of the sort of some of this population that has also high unemployment and feels sort of not fully integrated into French or French society or French culture, and it's not just France. Germany has some of these issues as well, and any number of the other countries that have colonial legacies and, you know, have citizens that came with those legacies that haven't always been fully integrated into the sort of broader national community. And I think that's part of what you're seeing with regard to the so-called homegrown individuals who are engaging with this kind of terrorism and destruction, is that where they are coming from in terms of their own lives in these countries has not always been one of progress and citizenship and, you know, full engagement with the community.
Professor Gorin, it's obvious for me, just from listening to everybody who's called in today, that this issue is dominating certainly political conversation of how we respond to ISIS, and it seems to me as though it's going to be that way for quite a good chunk of this presidential year. So my question is kind of a historical one. Where do we go in times when we are afraid? Do we go to somebody who understands politics, who seems somewhat reasonable, who can tell us this may not be able to be wiped out tomorrow or even in the next year? We have to be in this for the long haul. Or do we go with somebody who really does whip up fear?
Well, I mean, the first answer to your question is, if there in the past, in terms of presidential elections, if there's an opportunity for the incumbent to be reelected, we tend to reelect the incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, of course, what we saw in 2004 with the election of George W. Bush following 9/11. Obviously, that happened with regard to World War II and FDR. And you saw it with Lincoln in the Civil War. And there are a variety of, you know, sort of historical points where we sort of say, okay, well, the person who's been working with us, we know, and they know the information, and we sort of reelect them. And at the same time, this is not necessarily an opportunity where we have that capacity. And so then it becomes a question of, you know, who is the person that makes many of us feel more comfortable? Is it somebody who has knowledge? That may be for some folks, that's exactly what you want. For others, it may be kind of striking a strong balance of, you know, we need to take the fight to the terrorists approach. And so I think what you're seeing across the political spectrum are various sort of approaches to how to best position yourself as a candidate in this unknown situation. In part because ISIS, again, is not the same as Al-Qaeda in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of dealing with, a different enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, individuals are responding in different ways, and we have this sort of undercurrent of fear that's the post-9/11 period in which we're living.
One more minute, one more call. Erilyn Madison, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to mention we're going into all these countries preemptively on the fear of terrorism. I mean, from what I've heard, this ISIS hasn't gone to countries that have not attacked their countries. Well, they don't have a country right now, but I'm saying, like, we're just preemptively going, and then our government just keeps taking away more freedoms, and we're happy to let our freedoms go away.
All right, let's get a quick response. Professor Gorin.
Well, I mean, I think, again, this is sort of the difficulty that we often find ourselves in when we do feel like we're under threat, is that we often are willing as citizens to sort of cede some more of our freedoms and liberties to the government in order to ensure our security. And that's always a tension in our country, and has been since the founding.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Gorin, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, our pleasure. Lily Gorin, our guest this hour for All Things Political. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, editor of the book Women and the White House, Gender, Popular Culture, and Presidential Politics. And Not in My District, The Politics of Military Base Closures, and also And You've Come a Long Way, Baby, Women, Politics, and Popular Culture. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to you for all of your phone calls, Chris Molina for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. In case you're just discovering us for the first time, we always do this All Things Political segment every Monday at 1 o'clock. It's a chance to look at, particularly during presidential campaign time, what candidates have said and what your response is to where the race is at a particular time, and, of course, to the events like dealing with ISIS that are dominating the news, at least this week and probably next week as well. So, hour two of our show, the U.S. Post Office. How can we keep it financially solvent? Americans who are briefed on the issue have a lot of answers, and we'll hear about it, hour two.